It looked like an experiment gone terribly wrong, something from a nightmare. Part animal, part machine, the Griever rolled and clicked along the stone pathway. Its body resembled a gigantic slug, sparsely covered in hair and glistening with slime, grotesquely pulsating in and out as it breathed. It had no distinguishable head or tail, but front to end it was at least 6 feet long, 4 feet thick. Every 10 to 15 seconds, sharp metal spikes popped through its bulbous flesh, and the whole creature abruptly curled into a ball and spun forward. Then it would settle, seeming to gather its bearings, the spikes receding back through the moist skin with a sick slurping sound.
That's James Dashner reading from his New York Times best-selling sci-fi thriller, The Maze Runner. We first interviewed James on Word by Word Conversations with Writers right here on KRCB 91.1 FM in November 2010 after he released the second book in his young adult trilogy, The Scorch Trials. In October 2011, The Death Cure, the third and what most people assume was the final book in the trilogy, was released. But with over 1 million of the Maze Runner books in print, James could not leave this series, so a new prequel is on tap for release later in 2012. James Dashner, I want to welcome you to Word by Word.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I think it's important for our listeners to meet Thomas, the protagonist in both books. So could you read portions of the first chapter from your book, The Maze Runner? I've got them marked. It says start. I then skip a page and then stop.
Okay.
Basically, the first chapter is a little bit missing.
All right. Chapter 1. He began his new life standing up, surrounded by cold darkness and stale, dusty air. Metal ground against metal. A lurching shudder shook the floor beneath him. He fell down at the sudden movement and shuffled backward on his hands and feet, drops of sweat beading on his forehead despite the cool air. His back struck a hard metal wall. He slid along it until he hit the corner of the room. Sinking to the floor, he pulled his legs up tight against his body, hoping his eyes would soon adjust to the darkness. With another jolt, the room jerked upward like an old lift in a mine shaft. Harsh sounds of chains and pulleys, like the workings of an ancient steel factory, echoed through the room, bouncing off the walls with a hollow, tinny whine. The lightless elevator swayed back and forth as it ascended, turning the boy's stomach sour with nausea. A smell like burnt oil invaded his senses, making him feel worse. He wanted to cry, but no tears came. He could only sit there, alone, waiting. "My name is Thomas," he thought. That was the only thing he could remember about his life. He didn't understand how this could be possible. His mind functioned without flaw, trying to calculate his surroundings and predicament. Knowledge flooded his thoughts, facts and images, memories and details of the world and how it works. He pictured snow on trees, running down a leaf-strewn road, eating a hamburger, the moon casting a pale glow on a grassy meadow, swimming in a lake, a busy city square with hundreds of people bustling about their business. And yet he didn't know where he came from, or how he'd gotten inside the dark lift, or who his parents were. He didn't even know his last name. Images of people flashed across his mind, but there was no recognition, their faces replaced with haunted smears of color. He couldn't think of one person he knew or recall a single conversation. The room continued its ascent, swaying. Thomas grew immune to the ceaseless rattling of the chains that pulled him upward. A long time passed. Minutes stretched into hours, although it was impossible to know for sure because every second seemed an eternity. No, he was smarter than that. Trusting his instincts, he knew he'd been moving for roughly half an hour. "Someone help me!" he screamed. Each word ripped his throat raw. A loud clank rang out above him, and he sucked in a startled breath as he looked up. A straight line of light appeared across the ceiling of the room, and Thomas watched as it expanded. A heavy grating sound revealed double sliding doors being forced open. After so long in darkness, the light stabbed his eyes. He looked away, covering his face with both hands. He heard noises above, voices, and fear squeezed his chest. "Look at that Shank. How old is he? Looks like a clunk in a t-shirt. You're the clunk, Shuckface. Dude, it smells like feet down there. Hope you enjoyed the one-way trip, Greeny. Ain't no ticket back, bro." Thomas was hit with a wave of confusion, blistered with panic. The voices were odd, tinged with echo. Some of the words were completely foreign, others felt familiar. He willed his eyes to adjust as he squinted toward the light and those speaking. At first he could see only shifting shadows, but they soon turned into the shapes of bodies, people bending over the hole in the ceiling, looking down at him, pointing. And then, as if the lens of a camera had sharpened its focus, the faces cleared. They were boys, all of them, some young, some older. Thomas didn't know what he'd expected, but seeing those faces puzzled him. They were just teenagers, kids. Some of his fear melted away, but not enough to calm his racing heart. Someone lowered a rope from above, the end of it tied into a big loop. Thomas hesitated, then stepped into it with his right foot and clutched the rope as he was yanked toward the sky. Hands reached down, lots of hands, reaching for him, grabbing him by his clothes, pulling him up. The world seemed to spin, a swirling mist of faces and color and light. A storm of emotions wrenched his gut, twisted and pulled. He wanted to scream, cry, throw up. The chorus of voices had grown silent, but someone spoke as they wrenched him over the sharp edge of the dark box. And Thomas knew he'd never forget the words. "Nice to meet you, Shank," the boy said. "Welcome to the Glade."
Aha. So tell us about the Glade and the wall and the maze.
Yes. Thomas finds himself in this place called the Glade, where it's this large expanse of area where there's a little farm and there's a house. There's this little forest with a graveyard in it. And it's completely surrounded by these huge walls. And big doors in those walls lead out to these corridors that make up this huge maze. And the Glade is surrounded by this maze that all these other boys have been trying to find a way out of.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas, you know, his memory's been wiped, he's scared, he's confused, but he quickly has to adapt to this new life and slowly throughout the book start learning what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. And he finally decides what he wants to be as a runner.
Correct.
Which is what?
Yes. You know, this little society, you know, all these boys have been sent there. They call themselves the Gladers. And they're trying just to live their life day to day.
Longest time period is what, 2 years?
2 years, right. Yes. An original group of boys were sent there 2 years prior. And they've all established their own jobs in this place. Some work on the farm. Some are kind of a security force. Some are cooks. But the most elite job is being a runner. And these are the guys who go out in the maze every day and search it and map it and are trying to find a way out. And very quickly, Thomas decides that he wants to be a runner.
Mm-hmm. Why does that appeal to him?
Well,
I mean, he tries out other jobs. He goes in to the abattoir and decides he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to be a farmer, you know, pulling weeds.
Right. Yeah, I think he hates the other jobs. And number two, you know, you find out later why he's feeling this, but there's something about the maze that feels familiar to him. And it just pulls him.
Mm-hmm.
He just feels this need to get out into that maze and start exploring. And I think, you know, later on we start to understand why he's feeling that.
Right. Now, you have set up a whole new universe, a whole new world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, created it, I guess, from your own mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you play tricks with us as readers, though. We think we've got it all figured out. We're in the glade and it's surrounded by ivy-covered walls that go up, 30, 35 feet in the air and made of stone or some kind of material, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
We know everything that's going on, except then all of a sudden in page 28, something happens to those walls. Why don't you read that to us?
Okay. Yes. The enormous stone wall to the right of them seemed to defy every known law of physics as it slid along the ground, throwing sparks and dust as it moved, rock against rock. The crunching sound rattled his bones. Thomas realized that only that wall was moving, heading for its neighbor to the left, ready to seal shut with its protruding rods slipping into the drilled holes across from it. He looked around at the other openings. It felt like his head was spinning faster than his body, and his stomach flipped over with the dizziness. On all four sides of the glade, only the right walls were moving, toward the left, closing the gap of the doors. Impossible, he thought. How can they do that? He fought the urge to run out there, slip past the moving slabs of rock before they shut, flee the glade. Common sense won out. The maze held even more unknowns than his situation inside. He tried to picture in his mind how the structure of it all worked. Massive stone walls, hundreds of feet high, moving like sliding glass doors. An image from his past life that flashed through his thoughts. He tried to grasp the memory, hold on to it, complete the picture with faces, names, a place, but it faded into obscurity. A pang of sadness pricked through his other swirling emotions. He watched as the right wall reached the end of its journey, its connecting rods finding their mark and entering without a glitch. An echoing boom rumbled across the glade as all four doors sealed shut for the night. Thomas felt one final moment of trepidation, a quick slice of fear through his body, and then it vanished. A surprising sense of calm eased his nerves. He let out a long sigh of relief. "Wow," he said, feeling dumb at such a monumental understatement. "Ain't nothing, as Albie would say," Chuck murmured. "You kind of get used to it after a while."
Mm-hmm. So they're all sealed in at night.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons the runners have to come back every day.
Right.
Before the gates shut.
That's
or
correct.
They may never be seen except for their bones again.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah, there's bad things out in the maze that come out at night.
Things that go clump in the night, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. So where did this come from, this idea, manipulative future place?
You know, I think two books really heavily influenced me as I was brainstorming and coming up with the ideas for this book. One is Ender's Game, mm-hmm. by Orson Scott Card. You know, just the theme of a boy being sent to a place that he's not familiar with, that's full of other boys, you know, having to adapt to their society quickly,
right.
Learning the ropes, all that sort of stuff. And then the other book...
The Lost Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other book is Lord of the Flies.
Sure.
You know, just a bunch of
creating
boys...
Creating your own society.
Yeah, being thrown into a situation. You know, those are two books I loved growing up. And I just started thinking about, you know, my own version of that type of story. And I wanted it in the future, you know, in a kind of a post-apocalyptic world. And I wanted there to be heavy stakes for, you know, what's going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just want it to be an experiment where, for no real good reason, people are analyzing these boys. And as you go into books two and books three, you really start to see the big picture behind what they're doing to these people.
Right. Now, that's an interesting question. There's a movie called The Experiment, which was made in Germany, which is based on the Stanford Prison Experiment that was done in the early 70s.
Okay.
And what they did is they took a group of undergraduates, both males, made one of them the guards and one of them the prisoners. And then in within 3 days, there was complete anarchy. And we had an Abu Ghraib in the basement of one of the Stanford dorms, literally. So they had to stop it to save the kids. And but that doesn't happen here. There's a real order that's imposed. People, you know, do their jobs they need to do, even if they're not really happy about it. There's kind of a group, you called them sort of policemen, who go around and – but they're not really strong-arming them. They're kind of just using, you know, logic and and their words to control them, although there is that horrible thing that happens where they send someone out
the
just
banishment.
Before the –
Well, you know, I think maybe I was kind of making a statement. As much as I love Lord of the Flies, I like to believe that humans would not react that way in that situation. And so here these, you know, these teenagers are put in this situation on their own. They have the means to support themselves, and they have some terrifying things to keep them on their toes. But I think instead of degenerating, I would like to think that we'd become more determined, more organized, more set to do whatever it takes. And when you're in a situation like that, if you let go of order,
that's the word. That's the byword.
You will quickly fall into chaos, just like Lord of the Flies in this experiment you're talking about.
Right.
So they all just kind of have this agreement that we are not going to let that happen. We are determined to get out of here. And to do that, we need to work together.
And there's some serious consequences if they don't work together. They, you know, the dark place where you said with the cemetery has bodies buried.
Yep.
And they get one boy a month up the elevator delivered.
Right. Correct.
And but their population stays about constant.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's – if people break major rules and – which happens to a character in the book where he – you know, probably the worst rule you can break is trying to kill someone.
Right.
And so they banish him, which means they force him out into the maze at night.
Just before the door shut.
Just before the door shut. And that's how most people have lost their lives in the mazes, is being out at night and being attacked by the grievers.
Yeah, we're going to meet them in a minute.
Yes, they're not nice creatures.
No, they're not. I also noticed that both of these books, at least so far as I, you know, the trilogy, I know there's a third one coming, but they kind of follow the Hero with a Thousand Faces, you know, the Joseph Conrad, Campbell, who said, and I'm going to read this, "A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from his mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man." Did you have that in mind? I mean, that's obviously, you know, many people know that as the background of the Star Wars myth.
Mm-hmm. You know, I...
Odysseus. You name it.
Right.
Beowulf. Doesn't matter.
Well, I was... I wanted to be careful to make sure that Thomas seemed human. You know, I didn't want him just to be this superhero that never was scared and never did the wrong thing. And he does a lot of brave things throughout the story, but I think internally is where I really tried to show how human he is. He cries a few times. He's scared. He has doubts about himself. But,
which doesn't mean that heroes don't do that.
Well, yeah, true. I wanted to show his human side a lot, but I really did want him to be a hero figure. You know, I think in a lot of ways, the way he thinks is based on myself, but then he does things that I hope I would do.
You wish you could do.
Yes, wish.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure I would probably scream like a little girl and run the other way, actually. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's definitely, I tried to build him as a hero figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, he has some fierce competitors. In fact, I'm going to have you read about this one excerpt where he meets a griever. Actually, for the first time, he's heard them and he's seen glimpses through the window in the wall. Ah, that one, yes. Yeah. All right, we need 126.
Yes, okay.
Okay. In this excerpt, Thomas has saved another boy by carrying the unconscious body up an ivy-covered wall and then wrapping him in the vines. So he saved a boy who has been, you know, attacked.
Right.
But he has never seen the grievers, so he looks down to see them for the first time, if you could read that part.
Okay, here we go. Thomas stared in horror at the monstrous thing making its way down the long corridor of the maze. It looked like an experiment gone terribly wrong, something from a nightmare. Part animal, part machine, the griever rolled and clicked along the stone pathway. Its body resembled a gigantic slug, sparsely covered in hair and glistening with slime, grotesquely pulsating in and out as it breathed. It had no distinguishable head or tail, but front to end it was at least 6 feet long, 4 feet thick. Every 10 to 15 seconds, sharp metal spikes popped through its bulbous flesh, and the whole creature abruptly curled into a ball and spun forward. Then it would settle, seeming to gather its bearings, the spikes receding back through the moist skin with a sick slurping sound. It did this over and over, traveling just a few feet at a time. But hair and spikes were not the only things protruding from the griever's body. Several randomly placed mechanical arms stuck out here and there, each one with a different purpose. A few had bright lights attached to them. Others had long, menacing needles. One had a three-fingered claw that clasped and unclasped for no apparent reason. When the creature rolled, these arms folded and maneuvered to avoid being crushed. Thomas wondered what or who could create such frightening, disgusting creatures. The source of the sounds he'd been hearing made sense now. When the griever rolled, it made the metallic whirring sound, like the spinning blade of a saw. The spikes in the arms explained the creepy clicking sounds, metal against stone. But nothing sent chills up and down Thomas's spine like the haunted, deathly moans that somehow escaped the creature when it sat still, like the sound of dying men on a battlefield. Seeing it all now, the beast matched with the sounds. Thomas couldn't think of any nightmare that could equal this hideous thing coming toward him. He fought the fear, forced his body to remain perfectly still, hanging there in the vines. He was sure their only hope was to avoid being noticed. Maybe it won't see us, he thought. Just maybe. But the reality of the situation sank like a stone in his belly. The beetle blade had already revealed his exact position. The griever rolled and clicked its way closer, zigzagging back and forth, moaning and whirring. Every time it stopped, the metal arms unfolded and turned this way and that, like a roving robot on an alien planet looking for signs of life. The lights cast eerie shadows across the maze. A faint memory tried to escape the locked box within his mind, shadows on the walls when he was a kid, scaring him. He longed to be back to wherever that was, to run to the mom and dad he hoped still lived, somewhere, missing him. Searching for him. A strong whiff of something burnt stung his nostrils, a sick mixture of overheated engines and charred flesh. He couldn't believe people could create something so horrible and send it after kids. Trying not to think about it, Thomas closed his eyes for a moment and concentrated on remaining still and quiet. The creature kept coming.
So was that under your bed when you were a kid?
Well, you know, when I was developing this and thinking about what would be out in the maze, I really wanted it to be something original, something I created. You know, I didn't want goblins or trolls or vampires or werewolves. And I just started brainstorming. I thought, you know, this creature that part animal, part machine, I think it has no head or face, you know. You can't look it in the eyes, mm-hmm. which just, you know, means it has no soul. This thing is just created to wreak havoc and destroy and hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And this image of the disgusting flesh and, you know, mechanical arms popping through the flesh with nasty weapons on them. It's just, it's like everything that terrifies me and all wrapped into one.
So it was under the bed when you were a kid. Yes,
versions of it.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you said that you wanted to have this be original and fresh and not, you know, derivative, because it you could, which is surprising to me. You know, you go along, what you've done is you're manipulating the reader, but in a clever way, because we think we know what the rules are, mm-hmm. right? You do right. this, you run out in the daytime, you map the maze, you come back in before the doors close, you're going to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's gone on like that for years now, right?
Right.
Nope. So I won't give this away, but at any rate, they have to escape. And that leads us into the Scorch Trials because they, you know, not, I mean, obviously since it says that on the back of the book, yes. I can give that away.
Yes.
It's basically Thomas and a couple dozen other of the boys who were in the Glade, the Gladers, end up and find themselves in a entirely different place, almost a different world. And what I'd like you to do is, if you can, is read when he wakes up in a bed. Now, he hasn't been in a bed the whole time he was in the Glade. He slept outside, right. and he slept on the floor in mm-hmm. in a building. But anyway, he's wakes up.
There okay.
we go. Okay. So we're into the Scorch Trials.
All right. Finally, reality swept in, washed away the darkness. Engulfed in terror, Thomas opened his eyes and shot to a sitting position on his bed. Scooted out until he got his feet under him and jumped up. Looked around. Everything had gone crazy. The other gladers in the room were running around, shouting. And terrible, horrible, awful sounds filled the air, like the wretched squeals of animals being tortured. There was Frypan, pointing out a window, his face pale. Newt and Min-Ho were running to the door. Winston, hands held up to his frightened, acne-plagued face, like he'd just seen a flesh-eating zombie. Others stumbling over each other to look out the different windows, but keeping their distance from the glass. Achingly, Thomas realized he didn't even know most of the names of the 20 boys who'd survived the maze. An odd thought to have in the middle of all that chaos. Something at the corner of his eye made him turn to look toward the wall. What he saw immediately wiped away any peace and safety he'd felt talking to Teresa in the night. Made him doubt such emotions could even exist in the same world in which he now stood. 3 feet from his bed, draped by colorful curtains, a window looked out into a bright, blinding light. The glass was broken, jagged shards leaning against crisscrossed steel bars. A man stood on the other side, gripping the bars with bloody hands. His eyes were wide and bloodshot, filled with madness. Sores and scars covered his thin, sunburnt face. He had no hair, only diseased splotches of what looked like greenish moss. A vicious slit stretched across his right cheek. Thomas could see teeth through the raw, festering wound. Pink saliva dribbled in swaying lines from the man's chin. "I'm a crank," the horror of a man yelled. "I'm a bloody crank." And then he started screaming 2 words over and over and over, spit flying with every shriek. "Kill me, kill me, kill me."
Okay, you are listening to Word by Word Conversation with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa or streaming online at krcb.org. Tonight's conversation is with James Dashner, the best-selling author of the Maze Runner trilogy and featuring a quick-witted, clever, and athletic 15-year-old named Thomas who may be destined to save humankind either despite or because of an organization called WICKED, which is the chilling acronym for World in Catastrophe Kill Zone Experiment Department. Let's rejoin James Dashner as he shares more information from his latest book, The Scorch Trials. We've just heard the cranks outside the window screaming, "Kill me, kill me, kill me." And I thought when I read that, oh my gosh, a zombie book.
Oh.
Oh.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Kind
but you,
of.
Well,
not really.
Not really. You fool us again a couple times in the next few chapters that follow.
Yes. There's just an awful disease that's spreading across the world.
Or maybe.
Maybe.
We don't know how much of this is real and how much is
experiment. Yeah, they're still trying to figure things out. But, you know, they call this disease the flare.
Mm-hmm.
And it just attacks the brain and slowly drives people insane. And as they fall deeper and deeper into this abyss of lunacy and insanity, they just become monsters almost. They completely lose their humanity and they start acting like animals. And so really the only thing that a disease does is attack your brain, but kind of natural after effects is, you know, they get hurt and they get scars and sores and attack other people and just really turn into monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And once, you know, this character we meet at the beginning is just someone who's so desperate he wants someone to end his life.
Right.
Yeah.
But is he really there? Because we've kind of come to a safe haven. We've escaped, you know, the maze and gone through, I won't say how, but anyway, we've come to a place that's sort of like a dormitory with mm-hmm. beds and food and it's warm and safe and protected.
Right.
Right. Teresa has her own room. She goes off to the night, says goodnight, Thomas, right. in their mind because they can communicate that way.
Yes.
Next morning, wakes up, and then when they look out the window, this is what's outside. What is it?
Well, that's a very good point. Yes, they you find out a little bit in the first book and then as you go on that there are ways to manipulate their brains and nerve receptacles that sometimes they see things that aren't there. Or they don't see things that are there, or they can actually be controlled
mm-hmm.
if it comes down to that. And so,
yes, well, there's a new. Let's go about this control because let's look at page 30 in the Scourge Trials.
Okay,
there's a new level of control that's been placed on the gladers. Teresa is gone in the morning, and a new boy is in her bed named Eris. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
And he has something tattooed on his neck.
Okay. Eris shook his head, visibly upset. I don't have a clue, I swear. And there's no way that was there before last night. I showered, looked in the mirror, I would have seen it. And someone would have noticed it back in the maze, for sure. You're telling me they tattooed you in the middle of the night? Minho said. Without you noticing? Come on, dude. I swear, Eris insisted. Then he got up and went to the bathroom. Probably to try to see the words for himself. I don't believe a shuck word he says, Minho whispered to Thomas on his way back to his seat. Then, just as he leaned forward to plop back down on the mattress, his shirt shifted enough to reveal a thick line of black on his neck. Whoa, Thomas said. For a second he was too stunned to move. What? Minho asked, looking at Thomas as if he'd just sprouted a third ear on his forehead. Your neck, Thomas finally got out. You have it on your neck, too. What the shuck you talking about? Minho said, pulling at his shirt, face scrunched up as he struggled to see something he couldn't. Thomas ran over to Minho, slapped his hands away, then pulled the neckline of the shirt back. Holy, it's right there, same thing except... Thomas read the words to himself. Property of Wicked, Group A, Subject A7, the leader. What, dude? Minho yelled at him. Most of the other gladers had gathered in a tight group behind Thomas, squeezing in to get a look. Thomas quickly read the tattooed words out loud, surprised he did it without stumbling on them. You're kidding me, man, Minho said, standing up. He pushed his way through the crowd of boys, to follow Eris to the bathroom. And then the frenzy began. Thomas felt his own shirt tugged down as he pulled at others. Everyone started talking over everyone else. They all say Group A. property of wicked, just like his. You're subject A13, subject A19, A3, A10. Thomas was slowly turning in a circle, dazed as he watched the gladers discover the tattoos on each other. Most of them didn't have the additional designations like Eris and Min-Ho, just the property line. Newt was going from boy to boy, looking for himself, his face set in stone as if he were concentrating on memorizing the names and numbers. Then, quite by accident, the two of them stood facing each other. "What does mine say?" Newt asked. Thomas pulled the neckline of Newt's shirt to the side, then leaned over to read the words etched into his skin. "You're subject A5, and they called you the glue." Newt gave him a startled look. "The glue?" Thomas let go of his shirt and stepped back. "Yeah, probably because you're kind of the glue that holds us all together. I don't know. Read mine." "I already did." Thomas noticed that an odd expression had come over Newt's face. One of hesitation or dread. Like he didn't want to tell Thomas what his tattoo said. "Well?" "You're subject A2, Newt answered. Then he lowered his eyes. "And?" Thomas pushed. Newt hesitated, then answered without looking at him. "It doesn't call you anything. It just says, to be killed by Group B."
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, how'd you come up with the titles that you've given these guys?
Well, you know, a lot of the things that are happening in this story are...
Because you're the mind behind, you know, you're the man behind the curtain here, right?
This is true.
I gave it away. Darn it.
Yes. I'd like to think that I'm just telling a true story that I know about. But Yes, I did make it up. A lot of the words, you know, the titles they're giving do have meanings for later.
Mm-hmm.
But some of...
Well, I think that they have meanings for the part that we've already read, the way they acted in the glade.
Right. Yes. That's a good point. And I think, you know, the actual act of being tattooed in the middle of the night without knowing about it, that's an example.
If it happened in the middle of the night.
Well, yes. Yes.
If they're really there.
Yeah. You're good at understanding the gist of what's going on. All these things being done to them are... Like,
don't give away book three.
Well, you know, I know. I'm going to say this without telling.
I haven't read that yet. Don't give away.
I'm not going to say the why.
Okay.
But several times in both books, they mention the variables.
Right.
And I will say that there are people deliberately coming up with these variables for specific reasons to garner reactions. But it's not just for some scientific experiment that, you know, they want to publish an article in a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
They are...
They're not in the basement at Stanford.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. What Wicked is doing is literally the most important thing that's ever been done. And they feel completely justified in all these horrible things they're doing to these teenagers. So a lot of the little things are variables to stimulate reactions.
And they're providing clues.
Yes.
One of the first things that happens is just after they've awakened and they've seen the tattoos is that all of a sudden the room where they had been eating is hung with corpses.
Yes.
And then suddenly, a little bit later, the smell, which was overpowering, and all the bodies are gone.
Right.
Like they were never there.
Right.
So... we know that there's some manipulation going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, and it's very important how they're reacting, and certain things are being measured throughout this whole process. You know, this doesn't really give anything away, but towards...
it's so you're, hard getting, to, you're getting careful here. Right?
I know. It's so hard to talk about without giving spoilers.
Right.
But I can say this. You know, the word blueprint is mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And and building a blueprint. And I think that that is a very, very important clue that, that people might want to think about as they ponder and speculate, waiting for book three to come out.
Right. Well, book one, I think you're set on a – I mean, I had a real strong idea of the construct that we were on the surface of something. But then as it turned out, you remember the movie where the man has been watched by movie cameras his whole life and he's really living in a huge studio.
The Truman Show.
The Truman Show.
Yes.
And I had that feeling where there's this artificial sky above them and such, and the sun they thought that was regular may not be that way.
Right.
And but I kind of knew what that was. I mean, I said I knew what the rules were and could – okay, I can accept that. Mm-hmm. And then when we get to this next book, those rules don't apply.
Yeah, they're thrust out into
the middle of a wasteland.
Yes,
with a huge
portion of the real
sun.
World.
Yeah, yep. Well, maybe.
Well, I will tell you that that part, they are outside in the real world.
They're on the surface of a planet.
The whole world's not like that, but the part they're in is like that.
Southern Utah. Without the beauty of the of the wind-shaped canyons.
Yes. And, of course, the completely devastated city that they're approaching. Yes.
Now, the city is interesting. It's reminiscent of some of the cities from other science fiction works, you know, where there's things scuttling around, the cranks that are after them, the fact that they have to get from one side of the city to another because they have to go north. They've been given that instruction.
Mm-hmm.
They must occur and appear at a certain period on this, we'll say, the surface of the planet at a specific designated time to get the cure or they're going to die.
Right.
Because they've all been infected with this, the flare.
Right.
And I'm not giving too much away. This is on the back of the book, so I'm. In fact, let me read what the Kirkus Reviews wrote about it because I'm sure you'll like this. It says, Thomas led the gladers to safety in the Maze Runner, but after just one night's rest, the survivors are told that a true haven is still a long way off. To reach it, they have to pass another trial, crossing an expanse of scorched earth while being pursued by the cranks, humans infected with the flare, a disease that inflicts madness. If they can just make it to the designated meeting point on time and alive, they will be met by a rescue team from the shadowy organization behind those trials, Wicked, receive the cure to the pandemic, and never have to face danger again. Ha, 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 ha. We know there's a third book coming. We have the feeling there may be danger again. I assume you were very – this is from Kirkus Reviews, which is a very important thing to be get a good review in, and that's a very positive one.
Yes, we were thrilled with the review. You know, they called it a solid sequel and – that it was taut and kept you on the edge of your seat and stuff. So, you know, Kirkus sometimes can be brutally honest.
Oh, yeah.
So we were thrilled to have, you know, there was, wasn't one negative thing in the whole review. So we're thrilled.
Great, great. So we have the cranks chasing after them. But tell us about Group B. Because
Group B,
it's a parallel group to Group A, which was the boys.
Right.
With one girl, Teresa, who came in as the last person and was – what was her designation?
The
– she changes things, but what was she
called? Oh, the trigger.
The trigger, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And the other group is a Group B, which was all girls except for Eris, who ends
the,
up with
kind
the
of the opposite, yeah.
So they're both going across the surface of the planet in parallel lines.
Right.
You can see each other in the distance kind of thing.
Yes, you know, the construct of the these trials they're going through, it made the most sense to have the boys and the girls separated. They're both groups are there for very
well. If you're basing it on the Lord of the Flies, you kind of have to have.
Oh
that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And but it adds this element, like I said, these variables where they're. You know, purposefully inserting scenarios that create reactions in people. And just it creates a slew of emotions and reactions to we've always been boys, and suddenly this girl shows up. She's kind of weird. She comes with
She's in a coma, conveniently.
She's in a but she kind of, she wakes up with this creepy doomsday message. She's the last.
The end is nigh kind of thing. Yeah.
And it just creates all kinds of speculation and reactions in all the boys. And then the end, everything starts changing where the walls. Well, I don't want to give all
Don't give
away.
That away.
Yeah. But she brings change.
She's a catalyst.
She certainly brings change.
Yeah.
And the other group, the all-girls group.
I assume Eris was the last one there.
Yeah. It's kind of the exact opposite.
Parallel.
Right. Yep, very parallel. And then in book two, the two groups meet, sort of,
in
a creative way.
They have contact with each other, right?
And, it was funny when just the first book was out, I'd always get questions. Why is it all boys? Are you sexist? You don't think girls are strong enough to be there? And I kept saying, just read that last sentence of the book and guess about
You want to read the last sentence of the book?
Well, yeah, it says, at the very end it says, the lady who's behind all this, she says, Group B's trials results were also most extraordinary. I need time to process the data, but we can touch on it in the morning. That's the very end of the book, and that's the first time you hear about Group B.
Right, right.
And so I'd always tell people, well, just what do you think Group B might be if Group A is all boys? Maybe Group B, could be
Come
all
on,
girls.
Lead me along here, right?
So definitely not sexist.
Old people?
They're all babies.
Yeah, that's right. They're all put in little prams.
Yes.
Okay, well, we've got the boy-girl thing, though. And interestingly enough, Teresa and Thomas in the first book have a synaptic connection. They're able to talk to each other with their minds.
Right.
And they're the only ones who can do that we're aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that in the Scorch trials that Thomas is able to speak with Eris through his mind the same way. So the parallels are really, really strong.
Right.
However, when they end up in the city – there's a newcomer who appears.
Right.
And the subject of romance comes up. And not surprisingly, when you have a group of teenage boys and girls, you have hormone-driven desires, shall we call it that?
Yes.
But you handle this quite adroitly because in that abandoned city, Thomas is adopted by a girl named Brenda. Is that a good word for it? Adopted?
Sure.
Picked up, latched onto?
Takes him under her wing.
Yeah, because she knows things for his survival that's going to be helpful, and he's going to be able to lead her to get a cure because she's also infected. So let's read page 173 down here.
Brenda sighed and stepped even closer to him, pressing her chest against his. He felt her lips brushing his ear as she spoke. I want you to promise me something. She said it softly, and barely more than a whisper. Chills broke out all over Thomas's body. What? She didn't pull back, just kept speaking into his ear. No matter what happens, even if we have to go alone, you'll take me all the way back. All the way to Wicked, to that cure you promised Jorge. He told me about it in the storage room. I can't stay here and slowly go insane. I can't do it. I'd rather die. She grabbed both of his hands in hers, squeezed. Then she rested her head on his shoulder, her nose nestled against his neck. She had to be standing on the tips of her toes. Each breath from her sent a new wave of chills across his skin. Thomas was enjoying her being so close, but it seemed so bizarre and out of the blue. Then he had a surge of guilt, thinking of Teresa. All this was stupid. He was in the middle of a brutal and ruthless attempt to make it across a wasteland, his life on the line, his friends may be dead. Teresa could even be dead. To sit here and cuddle with some strange girl in the dark was about the most absurd thing he could think of. Thomas let go of her, leaned his head back against the wall. She pressed in again and wrapped her arms around his middle. Brenda? He asked. Something wasn't right with this girl. Yeah? She mumbled against his chest. What are you doing? What do you mean? Don't you think it's a little weird how you're acting? She laughed, such an unexpected sound that Thomas thought for a second she'd succumbed to the flare. become a full-blown crank or something. She pulled away from him, still chuckling. What? He asked. Nothing, she said through a schoolgirl snicker. Guess we came from different places, that's all. Sorry. What do you mean? He suddenly found himself wishing she'd hug him again. Don't worry about it, she said, her merriment at his expense finally subsiding. Sorry for being so forward. It's just pretty normal where I come from. No, it's okay. I'm good. He was glad she couldn't see his face, because it must have burned so red she'd start laughing all over again.
Okay. So we have sex, but it's a YA book, so not too much, right?
There you go.
And but it's interesting. I don't think it's really written – I know it's for that audience and appropriate for that audience, but mm-hmm. I think people of any age can be involved in that. You have groupies who follow you around? Here?
Oh, yes, of course.
Oh, yes.
No, I absolutely intended this for all ages, older ages. You know, I – not once when I wrote this book that I – think of, oh, I'm writing this for teenagers. I need to write this way.
Dumb
it down or anything. If I had written this book for adults, I think it would be the exact same book. So,
well, it's interesting the comparison there about her references, because we find out little about Brenda, where she came from.
Right.
But she's just there in the city. And I don't think Thomas even asks her, does he ever? They never follow up on that, or at least not in this book.
You find out in the third book that she's from Alaska.
Ah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But
that is a different place.
Yes, yeah. It definitely is.
So is this the way you felt coming from Georgia to the big university? the girls were different here or something?
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit. Not to embarrass you, of course.
No. No, romance is very big in the young adult market.
Right.
And pretty much
– especially between vampires and
humans. Yes. Right. I could have really made it awesome and made Brenda a vampire. That would have shook it up.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some pretty close twos there. The cranks get awful close to certainly to zombies. I don't know. Vampires, they live forever though, don't they? Yeah, I don't know.
But, you know, so – and I definitely do not see myself as a romance writer, but – just to throw a little taste of it in there, because mm-hmm. they are teenagers, it would be very unrealistic if there's absolutely no romantic inclinations.
Mm-hmm.
But the story is such a dark, brutal one that, you know, there's not a whole lot of time for lovey-dovey stuff. So that kind of saved me from having to do it too much.
Is it a male? Did you write it for a male audience?
Well.
Or did you think?
I wrote it.
Who was your audience?
My audience was people who like to read the books I like to read.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I mean, I my number one goal with these books was to entertain people.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the cool thing that I never thought about, but my publisher stresses all the time, is that this – they love it because it's a boy book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the girls will read it too, where the opposite doesn't work. Boys – aren't too keen on reading girls' books.
Mm-hmm.
So they saw this great opportunity to have a book that would appeal to both the boys and the girls in this young adult market, where before now, the vast majority of this market has been marketed toward girls. So I really think that's one reason Random House has put so much support and marketing and stuff behind this book.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to hit both audiences. So
you just today, you were at a high school, is that right?
Uh-huh.
Yep. And tell me, how did that go? What did they – have they read the book? Are they familiar with your characters?
Yes. It's so fun. Usually, you know, in every city I go to, they have me visit a couple of schools.
Mm-hmm.
And normally the librarian is just so enthusiastic, you know, to have a real author coming to the school. And most of the times they've read the book, which is just – a blast to go and face-to-face, talk to my readers. You know, they grill me with questions, trying to get me to reveal everything that happens in the third book. And they won't let go. They just keep pushing and pushing. And I always give them I throw them a few bones, but uh-huh. I make sure I don't spoil anything too big. But it's fun.
No,
I love
spoilers here today either.
Yeah. Okay. I love going to the schools. It's fun.
So what kinds of questions do they ask over and over and over again?
Oh, well, this series specifically, they're always asking me, you know, what's really going on? Why, you know, why is this happening to them? What is wicked? What is the kill zone? All this stuff. But what's funny, today there was
the answers to that are in the pages of the book.
They're in
most
the pages.
Of them.
Yeah. In fact, I was telling him today, you know, Thomas has several dreams in the second book where he remembers things. Mm-hmm. And I told them, you know, for fun, go back and read those dreams a few times. You'll be shocked at how much is revealed. And it was cute, though. Today, this one girl, she says she's absolutely in love with Newt. And she must have asked me 30 times. She kept coming up to me afterwards.
The glue.
She kept asking me, does Newt die in the book, third book? I have to know. I have to know. Does Newt die?
Well, it's a good question because a lot of the gladiators do die. There's a significant body count in these.
Yes. Yes. It's a, you know, a major character dies in the first book and people ask me why. And the real reason is I want my readers to never feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want them just to assume, oh, this guy's a main character, so he can't die.
Mm-hmm. But I was always suspicious of that character anyway.
Yeah. Well, he's...
You wrote him that way intentionally, I assume.
Well, I wanted to show...
Because nobody could be that dense.
Well, I wanted to show Chuck...
Oh, oops.
I hope I didn't give something
no,
away.
No, we didn't. Nobody heard that.
I wanted to show... I wanted to show that character... He was younger than everyone else, and I wanted to show he has this almost sick, childlike fascination for the dark stuff that's going mm-hmm, on in this mm-hmm, place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets excited about the banishment,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of disturbs Thomas. But he also has this innocence because he's younger, and he hasn't figured life out yet.
So what kind of character, if you were to parallel him with something from some other classic literature, who would he be? Sancho Panza?
Well, he was kind of an homage to Piggy.
Okay.
From Lord of the Flies.
All right, that works. I got that. Yeah.
And I always pictured...
Well, see, we got some parallels there, don't we?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I always picture the funny fat kid from The Goonies.
Mm-hmm.
So... Definitely he was inspired by other books and movies.
James Dashner, I want to thank you for joining us on Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM, and I wish you continued good luck with your Maze Runner trilogy and look forward to the prequel, The Kill Order, when it comes out later in 2012. Tonight's Word by Word broadcast was engineered by Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. Be sure to tune in at 7 o'clock on Wednesday, February 1st, when our conversation will be with the exciting Serbian writer Tija Obrett with her New York Times bestselling novel, The Tiger's Wife. Until then, we hope that you live long and prosper throughout 2012.